This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and joining me now is Chip Brantley. He is one of the investigative reporters and co-hosts, along with Andrew Beck Grace, of the podcast White Lies, which takes a deep dive into an unsolved murder from the 1960s, one of the most prominent unsolved murders of the civil rights era, that of the beating death of the minister, James Reeb. Chip, thank you so much for joining us today.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
So it is a 7-part series. We have been playing the shows Tuesday nights. We're coming up on episode 3 this week. The show is called White Lies. And of course, usually a white lie, something pretty harmless. You know, you tell your elderly aunt that you love the crochet doilies that she gives you. But in this case, as you explore racial injustice, to put it in the lightest possible terms, of the civil rights era, you choose a title like White Lies. Why did you want to call it that?
Yeah, it's funny. That title came out of NPR well into the process. But at first, we had a much less enticing, provocative title called In Fact, which we loved, Andy and I loved, but everyone else hated. Because I thought it sounded like a 1970s NewsHour type show that you would find on public television, and just didn't feel like it had the right ring. So somebody at NPR came up with that name, and we didn't like it at first, but really grew to love it because we felt like what it did is that you're right that it usually when you tell a white lie, it's something that's small and inconsequential. In this case, we felt that it, of course, tapped into the exploration of whiteness that we get into in the show as a race story that involves whiteness and sort of different modes of whiteness. Of course, the attack that you referred to was a bunch of white men attacking other white men. Usually, you know, in the civil rights movement, we think of all the black folks who died leading up to the civil rights movement over the course of the first part of the 20th century. And many of those murders are also still unsolved. But we thought that the title White Lies really got at all the different ways that lies are wielded in the story. All the lies that were told in the 60s and that continued because they were unchallenged. And of course, those are smaller, more specific lies that are connected to this broader lie of white supremacy that has really infused this country since its founding.
This is the death of a white man, and I am curious, before we even get into the story that you're aiming to tell here, you mentioned there are a lot of unsolved crimes of the civil rights era, and a lot of the episode talks about white privilege, and specifically that a white death, and therefore a white life, is more meaningful than a black death and therefore a black life. And yet you're focusing on the death of a white man during the civil rights movement. Why not focus on an untold black death?
You know, that's a question we thought a lot about during the course of reporting the story. And I should say right off the bat that Jim Reeb's death was no more or less important than any of the hundreds and thousands of black folks who died during the Jim Crow South and during the Civil Rights Movement. And many of those murders are still unsolved, as you say. And later in the show, we actually do get into a case that's of a black man who was killed during the voting rights campaign in the nearby town of Marion. We referenced him in the first episode, Jimmy Lee Jackson, who was killed just a few weeks before Jim Reeb. And one of the really interesting things about focusing on Jim's Reeb murder for us was that it shows, when you look at the response around the country, not just in the South, but all around the country, when you look at the response to Jim Reeb's death in 1965 compared to the death of Jimmie Lee Jackson, you see very clearly the value of a white life versus a black life, and really digging into Reeb's murder and the impact it had. LBJ mentions him in his introduction of the Voting Rights Act when he goes to before both houses of Congress. Thousands of people protest around the country. It was front page news all over the world. One of the really interesting things is just to look at that, to see the response to his death versus Jimmie Lee Jackson's death when they were so close together. The other interesting thing, sort of tied to that, is that in some ways it's really understandable. It's terrible and tragic and really revealing, but it's also understandable that so many of those black deaths have gone unsolved because no one was really interested in solving them. People were interested in what happened to Jim Reeb, and the fact that it has remained unsolved or remained unsolved for so long really drew us as reporters. And it really felt like we could, it was a chance for us to, again, look at this lie that was created to absolve not just Selma, but really Alabama and sort of white culture in the South. And so really looking at Reeb's death really allowed us to do that.
For anyone who hasn't heard the first two episodes, you can catch up at npr.org/white lies. But basically, you and co-host Andrew Beck Grace are investigating the death of a Unitarian minister who saw what happened on Bloody Sunday, a terrible attack on black lives and white allies as they were marching for voting rights in Selma, Alabama in 1965. You just said that, you know, you want to be exploring sort of what it means to be white now, and that the fact that this case went unsolved for 50 plus years is why you wanted to tell that story. But what specifically about more than 50 years made you even think this was possible right now?
Well, to be totally honest, we didn't know for sure. So when we, you know, so I live in Birmingham. I'm from Birmingham. Andy lives in Tuscaloosa. And in 2013, 2014, we were honoring some of the anniversaries of some of the milestones of the Civil Rights Movement, the Children's Campaign in Birmingham in 1962. And then, of course, some of the terrible events from that era, the church bombing in 63, the Freedom Summer. And so around that time, we were talking to Jerry Mitchell, who's widely considered to be kind of the father of civil rights cold cases. He's a reporter, longtime reporter in Mississippi, worked for the Clarion Ledger for a long time, and now is an independent journalist in Mississippi. He did the reporting that led to the sort of Mississippi burning case, and he did a lot of reporting around the church bombing in Birmingham that led Doug Jones in the early 2000s to reopen those cases against two of the bombers. So we were talking to Jerry, who mentioned the Reeb story, Mitch and Jim Reeb. And Andy and I, as I said, both grew up in Alabama. And our response was, who? Who's Jim Reeb? We'd never heard of this name before. And the fact that we had not heard of him was, as a reporter, really interesting. And we've, you know, we both consider ourselves students of this era. We'd read a lot about it. And of course, growing up here, but the fact we'd never heard of this guy's name and then just did a little research and saw what a huge deal it was in 1965 made us interested in that story just from a sort of personal wanting to know more about what happened. And if you just do a cursory glance at the Wikipedia or do a Google search for Jim Reeb, you get a lot of information about the case. And so that led us to want to know more about like why no one had ever been held accountable. And so we just started going to Selma and talking to people and ended up making a little short documentary. Andy's background is in documentary film. So we made a short documentary. And in the course of doing that short documentary, which focused on one of the men who was with Reeb that night, his name was Clark Olson. We went and spent a lot of time with Clark and talked to him about the case and his memories of the case. And he really has talked about this a lot over the course of his later life. It was really, of course, a huge event for him. In the course of talking to Clark and talking to others in Selma, we were faced with what we call in episode 3 of the show, this counter narrative, this story that was advanced in Selma about what really happened to Jim Reeb that night. And when we heard that as reporters, we thought we have got to dig into this more to try to debunk it or try to get to the truth about what happened. In the course of doing that, really, really came into contact with the people and the context who would eventually allow us to solve the case and get a definitive account about what happened.
Well, I don't want to give away any spoilers here, but you mentioned that counter narrative, and that becomes a huge part of the rest of the series, is that there was a death and that there were people who were responsible and yet never held responsible in the eyes of the law. And it kind of turns into sort of an existential or philosophical look on the lies or the stories that we tell ourselves to feel good or to sort of justify our actions. Is that a fair way to talk about the counter narrative without spoilers here?
Definitely, yeah. I mean, I think that's exactly right. I think that this counter narrative that was advanced in 1965 really became the underpinnings for the trial that happened in December of 1965 that led to the acquittal of three men. It was a story crafted, I think, not only to absolve those three men, but to absolve the town of any wrongdoing. It was a type of story that was common. We actually, in this upcoming third episode, we talked to two prosecutors who pursued civil rights cold cases in the 70s and the 90s. And the story that was advanced in Selma was very similar to stories that were advanced after, say, the church bombing in 1963 in Birmingham. In fact, one of the characters we talked to in episode three says when he looked back at the police files, the Birmingham Police Department's files, when they began their investigation of the church bombing, he said most of the investigative work done early on was investigating the black community and the civil rights activists for bombing the church to get sympathy for their cause. That was the mentality. And so these types of lies, even though to us it just seemed outrageous when we first encountered it, these types of lies were very, very common. And that, you know, I think that it doesn't take too much of a stretch of imagination to see that some of those same types of lies are being told today.
The trial ends up being an enormous miscarriage of justice. I wonder, did it get hard for you and your fellow reporter and co-host, Andrew Beck Grace, to even just write down some of the things and say what you had to say? For example, the defense attorney was a known Klansman.
This is one of the things that we struggled with and as storytellers, is that some of the things that we encountered in Selma in the course of reporting the story were not at all surprising to us because they were so common in that era. The fact that these three guys were acquitted is not at all surprising when you look at what was surprising was there was a trial. You know, I mean, for the longest time, it wouldn't even lead to a trial. It was just the widespread publicity about this. In fact, the prosecutor, we have a reporter who interviewed the prosecutor. We interviewed this reporter a few years ago, and he covered the trial. And when he covered the trial, he talked to the prosecutor. He was working for the New York Times at the time, and he talked to the prosecutor, and the prosecutor said, I don't have a strong case. This is going to be an acquittal. And he's like, well, why are you even bringing it to trial? And he said, because if I don't bring it to trial, you're going to, you know, kill me in the press. So I've got to do it. So in some ways, what's surprising about any of this was that there was a trial in the first place. You know, what's remarkable is that I mentioned Jerry Mitchell earlier. After we talked to Jerry and started to look into this case, he had somehow gotten a copy of the FBI file, the original FBI investigation into Jim Reeb's death. And the reason the FBI investigated it was because so much of, you know, Selma during that voting rights campaign from January to really through the end of March proper, so much of it was protected by federal court order. So much of the demonstrations and the marches, and of course Bloody Sunday had just been a couple of days before, and so there were tons of federal agents on the ground. But Jerry was able to get this FBI file some years ago, and it's a remarkable roadmap for a case like this. And in some ways, the FBI, who, you know, the mid-60s FBI, you don't, when you think of the FBI in the 1960s, you don't think of being very sympathetic to the civil rights movement. But these agents who were on the ground, some of whom I'm sure were not happy about the assignment and not in support of the civil rights movement, but still some of those agents on the ground did a remarkable job of investigating and really gave us a roadmap to look into this case.
Bookending the podcast, you and Andrew both call out your own family's racist histories, talking about being slave owners and Confederates. Why is that important? What does it do besides assuage your own white guilt?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I think we struggled with who are we in this story? It's not like our grandfather was one of the attackers or something like that. You know, the reason that we did it is that a big part of the story and a big part of the story of the aftermath of the death of Jim Reeb, the killing of Jim Reeb, is that white Southerners and white Americans, I would say, for the most part, don't know how to talk about race and history and guilt and shame. You know, I think we've been really bad at that. And I think that's borne out every day now. We're still bad at it. We've never had proper truth and reconciliation in this country. Without it, I really feel like there's little to no hope for true racial justice. The white South we grew up in, as we say in the first episode, just didn't talk about it. I mean, we did not talk about this era. I never heard about this story when I was growing up, this huge national story in 1965 that led to, in direct ways and indirect ways, the passage of one of the most momentous domestic laws in the Voting Rights Act ever passed in this country that truly made, in some ways, America, America. You know, a lot of people would say the American experiment really started in 1965 when everyone then had the right to vote. So I think that acknowledging our own past was not a way to assuage our own guilt, but I think it was a way to say, like, we need to just be honest about where we come from. I mean, one of the amazing things about working on a story like this is that you see how close this past is. It's not like we think of 50 years ago, we think about the distant past. But it was really not long at all. I mean, we talked to so many people who were a part of this story. And just in the course of working on the story, it's 5 years has passed. So that's a tenth of that time. And you start to sort of see that really it's these generations. I think we tend to look at the past as this distant place when it is so close. And we really don't evolve that much. I think you can see that now when you look around the country, how little has really has changed or evolved. We've changed the way we've talked about it. We've begun to talk about it more, but we still haven't found a way to officially talk about it. We wanted to open up that dialogue for ourselves, not to assuage our own guilt. I mean, I honestly don't feel guilty about an ancestor who had slaves. I think it's important to be honest about it, but I don't wake up feeling guilty about it. I do think about the privileges that that past has granted me through the generations, and I try to live my life in a way that somehow addresses some of that privilege. But I think that, you know, we have a habit in this country. I think we talk about race to talk about personal behavior, and I think we really need to be talking about, of course, these broader systems of power, these systems of impunity that were alive and well in Selma in 1965, and they were alive and well in Selma when we came back to look into the story 50 years later.
Since the podcast first came out in 2019, and of course it took many, many years of reporting, we have seen a dramatic increase in the Black Lives Matter movement, and there has been still a number of police murders. And I'm looking, of course, at George Floyd and then Breonna Taylor. And I'm wondering, how do you think the same story that you're telling now might be different if it had happened now versus 1965?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a storytelling question. I think it's also one of the things that really drew us to this story is that you have this passage of time to explore in the story. So it is not just simply a story about a crime and trying to solve it, but it's a way of trying to provide the context to situate the story. I think you lose some of that, you know, as a storyteller, you lose some of that, of course, if you're doing a contemporary story. But I do think that there are plenty of stories that we think we know because we read about them on the news or we hear about them, that of course become much more complicated and complex and say a lot more about the broader culture once we dig into them. I think that they're obviously different. You'd have to tell that story in different ways, you looking into some of these crimes, because they're so well covered when they happen. I think there are ways to do it. I just finished listening to a podcast called Nice White Parents, which is a new podcast from Serial Productions. And the host, Hanna Duffy Walt, does an amazing job of blending the past in with the present and looking at the ways in which what's happening right now is in some ways a recurrence of what happened, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago. And I think those types of stories and the way that she tells that story is super interesting. And I think that's kind of a way that you might be able to tell a more contemporary story by digging into the context that got us here. And I think there's been some really good examples of storytellers who have done that and journalists who have done that recently.
Chip Brantley is one of the co-reporters and co-hosts alongside Andrew Beck Grace of the podcast White Lies. You can listen to the whole series Tuesday nights on Prairie Public or at npr.org/ White Lies. Chip, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Ashley. I enjoyed it.